Good morning. Charlie Stenholm isn't here this morning to enforce his rule that we start promptly 7 minutes late, so I'll start a few minutes earlier than that. My name is Neil Conklin. I'm president of Farm Foundation, and I'd like to welcome everybody to our first Farm Foundation Forum of 2010. I look out there and see a lot of familiar faces, so I know many of you have been to our forums before. But just by way of introduction, we do 10 of these forums a year, usually the first or second Tuesday of the month. You find the announcements on our website. And what we try to do is to tackle issues that are critical to food, agriculture, and rural America. We also try to take a global perspective, and today's forum is one of those that really does take a global perspective. I guess I would note that today is Groundhog's Day, February 2nd. My wife's favorite movie is Bill Murray's movie Groundhog Day. And for those of you who haven't seen it, Bill Murray lives the same day over and over and over again. And I think maybe that's appropriate as I think about where we're about what we're talking about today. Today we have Gail Buchanan, who's here to present a paper that has just been released by the Council on Agricultural Science and Technology. The paper focuses on agricultural productivity strategies for the future. And I know last year we released our report, The 30-Year Challenge, looking at what the challenges are that lie ahead for agriculture. Last year, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs issued a major report, a group chaired by Catherine Bertini and Dan Glickman, looking at the challenges that we face if we're going to restore the United States' leadership in global agricultural development, and so on. I know you may hear from some of our panelists today about other reports that have come out or may be coming out. So as it's over and over, we're hearing these messages that there are big challenges facing agriculture ahead if we are going to have the output that it takes to feed, as we said, to feed and fuel a growing world. So with that, I'm going to turn the, I better say something about the ground rules for those of you who haven't been here. We generally try to go for no more than an hour with our presentations and then reserve the last hour for Q&A and discussion. And that's, to me, one of the most valuable parts of these forums is the audience participation as much as what we hear from the folks, the great folks that we get up front. So be thinking about your questions. And when we get to the end of the formal presentations, we'll start the discussion. We do record these sessions, and the recordings can be found on our internet site, usually within 24 hours of the time this is over. So if you're looking for can't remember exactly what was said, you can pull that MP3 file down, and if you're a real glutton for punishment, listen to the whole 2 hours, or you can try to search through it and pick out what you were looking for. Anyway, so because we record this, I would ask that when it comes to the Q&A, please be sure to use the microphone. Cue up at the microphone to make your comments and to identify yourselves. With that, let me introduce John Bonner from CAST, who will introduce Gail Buchanan, who is the lead author on the paper, which is in the back. And then Jonathan Bryant and Johanna Nesseth are our two discussants, and I'll introduce them in more detail when we get to the end of the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. We're really happy to be here this morning with the newest paper from CAST. Those of you that aren't familiar with CAST, it's been around 37 years. The first paper was done by Dr. Norman Borlaug, and you'll hear more about his involvement in this paper. CAST is made of 30-plus scientific societies, companies, nonprofit organizations. We are rather unique in that we put together scientific papers by volunteer authors. They are peer-reviewed by volunteer reviewers, and the commentaries, which are 3,000-word publications, or the issue paper, like you're hearing today, 6,000-word, are free online and available to anyone in the world. Our larger task force reports are available to anyone with a .gov address, state or national. 32,000 people downloaded these last year, and we have a very good fit with what Farm Foundation does and trying to pull this all together. We were on the Hill yesterday, and Gail spoke to 85 staff members, so we had very good attendance there. So I think you're going in for a treat with a very good speaker and a good publication that a lot of hours went into by the authors. And we hope that you'll find this useful and share it with a number of people by telling them to go ahead and download it off of the CAST website. You can have the entire publication. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Gail Buchanan. He's been involved with CAST for a number of years. He was undersecretary under the Bush administration in USDA, at the University of Georgia and Alabama as dean. So, and he's a native of Florida. He said, don't say too much, so I'll turn it over to him to carry on from here.
Thank you, John, and good morning. It's really a pleasure to be here. I see so many old friends, and that says something about the age of some of us, but it's really good to be here this morning to have the opportunity to share a few thoughts about the CAST Report Number 45, Agricultural Productivity Strategies for the Future. I was honored to be a member of a writing team that included two very distinguished economists, Luther Tweeten from The Ohio State University, and Bob Hurt, formerly with the Rockefeller Foundation, and now at Cornell University. Dr. Borlaug is truly a giant, especially for those of us that's engaged in some facet of agriculture. Although he's been recognized in many different ways, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal, and many other ways, probably his greatest contribution was the vision he had for the future and how to feed people of the world. And that is something that I think is tremendously important. In this paper, we describe some of the challenges facing agricultural productivity and strategies that's going to enable agriculture to meet those expectations in the future. We do not explicitly address a number of issues that you might think important and are very important. For example, we don't try to get into food safety, which is certainly important, international trade barriers, food prices and income support, and all of the other types of farm programs. Rather, what we try to do in this paper is focus on the basic need for developing information, knowledge, and technology that's going to enable us to be successful in surviving on this planet in the years ahead. Given the finite nature of agricultural productivity resources such as land, water, nutrients, and the myriad of constraints that agriculture has in everyday life, future success of agricultural productivity rests with increasing the efficiency and the ensuring the sustainability of agriculture. And that, I think, is the heart of our comment today. The principal drivers of agricultural demand in the future, clearly, is increase in population. And certainly the population is stabilized in some countries, but is still growing in many other countries and projected to reach some 9 billion by the middle part of this century. And there's another driver, and that is even countries that have adequate food are looking to improve their status. Everybody wants better quality food, more meat, more protein, and that's going to be one of the drivers. There's going to be increases in income, and what happens as countries increase income? The first thing they want to do is eat better. Some eat too well. But there's another real important point that I think we should not overlook, and that is a simple fact that there's going to be a part of agricultural output that's going to be used in producing energy in the years ahead, and I think that's a given. Well, based on the median expectations in population increases, including the demand for agricultural products for non-food demands, is projected that 143% of the output of the year 2000 will be required to meet the expectations in 2025. It's also projected to be 179% of 2000 output in the year 2050. This brings about a new paradigm in agriculture, and I know this is one of my favorite topics. I've used to give a lot of speeches on the new paradigm in agriculture. This does bring about a new paradigm. Clearly, in the future, petroleum is going to become more limited, and as it becomes more limited, it's going to become more expensive. I don't think there's any question that we're nearing the end, if we haven't already reached the end, of the era of cheap petroleum. This fact, along with the recognition that agriculture can contribute to the energy picture, is going to demand that in the future, any agricultural policy takes in consideration the energy relationships it has with agriculture. While agriculture is already facing many challenges, there's a lot of current and emerging constraints that we ought to take into consideration. Some of these you know, and you probably know all of them well, but certainly soil erosion is still a concern in many parts of the world. It's still a concern in parts of this country. That's a problem. Water is going to be one of the real challenges in the years ahead, and I'm pleased that Cass has already addressed this in a very comprehensive paper. But this is clearly one of the challenges we see in the years ahead, is how do we deal with the water, or lack thereof, or too much in some countries. Also, the lack of support for bioengineered crop plants is one that is really serious to me, and I think is going to be very important. Plants that are bioengineered to withstand problems of soil salinity, to heat, to too little moisture, too much moisture, all of these things, if we solve these problems, they're going to be solved by genetic engineering, I can assure you. There's a lot of voices in this country, even and certainly in some other countries, that still oppose the use of genetically modified crops. And this is certainly a constraint that I hope will be sorted out in the years ahead. Protein from animal sources comprise an important component of the diet of many people around the world. However, particularly in Europe and even in this country to some extent, there's strong voices that oppose animal agriculture. And this is a deep concern that I think we're going to have to be concerned with in the future, is how do we ensure animal agriculture has a place in our society? The Endangered Species Act is another constraint that I think we should be concerned about. No one can argue about the importance of protecting the nation's and the world's flora and fauna. It's very important that we maintain diversity. But it should be borne in mind that maintaining this diversity comes at a price. In the final analysis, decisions must be made after carefully weighing the cost versus the benefit of protecting endangered species. And of course, when you talk about the issue of sustainability, the first thing that comes to my mind is plant nutrients. The first, of course, is nitrogen. And of course, nitrogen is one of the most readily available plant nutrients. It's in the air. In fact, 78% of the air we breathe is nitrogen. Unfortunately, plants can't use that except for legumes. And it's a little bit like going to a banquet and having a huge tray of food and not having a plate and a knife and a fork. You can see all that good stuff there, but you can't eat it. And that's the case with nitrogen in the air. In fact, to put nitrogen from the air into a use that can be taken up by plants, it takes, for the most part, nowadays, it comes from using natural gas, which is another finite energy resource. But that's certainly one. We also have plenty of potassium. Unfortunately, we don't have that much phosphorus. In fact, in 2008, we extracted some 8 million tons of phosphorus from the reserves we have in this country, which is some 34 million tons. And that means that we're going to run out of phosphorus in this country in a little over 100 years. And so that means we're going to have to be concerned about that plant nutrient in the days ahead. And of course, global climate change, and regardless of what's causing it, we know there are changes that's occurring. Some places are going to have too much water, some places too little water, some places too hot, some places too cold. There's going to have real dramatic impacts on agricultural productivity in the days ahead. So that's certainly got to be considered as a major constraint in the future. As the world becomes more global in nature, there's a greater need to consider agricultural productivity from a global perspective. There's four countries in particular that I think we need to keep our eye on. China and India, which are already major population centers, are going to continue to be major population centers and create major demands for agricultural output in the days ahead. Brazil, on the other hand, is probably the major country on the planet that has still yet potential for increased agricultural productivity in the future. Conversely, sub-Saharan Africa comprises some 45 different countries, most which are small, most which have fragile governments, most which have poor transportation, communications, and a lot of other things that they don't have. It's going to be a part of the world in which food is very severely limited. That's the part of the world that today people live close to the hunger edge, and that's another part of the world we need to keep our eyes on in the future. Well, future success of agricultural productivity requires a supportive infrastructure, and that, I think, goes without saying. And much of that's got to come from the public sector. Clearly, the private sector is not going to be investing in those areas because it's simply impossible to find a way to make a profit. An industry can't survive without making a profit. So that leaves the development of infrastructure to many of these countries around the world, to the public sector to do that. And that, I think, is a real challenge we see facing us. That brings up the question, how do we help these less developed countries develop that infrastructure? Well, I have a few things that my colleagues and I agreed on, and first is we got to continue providing humanitarian support for these countries, and I think that goes without saying, just as we're doing today in Haiti. We must continue to build the institutions and intellectual capacity that enables countries to do that. I'm reminded of little cliche that I've used so often, and that is that if you give a man a fish, you fill his belly for one meal. But if you teach him to fish, he can stay full until he catches all the fish in the pond. But if you teach him to fish and teach him to grow fish and grow fish sustainably, you've got him fixed for life. And that's in essence what we want to do on a grander scale in helping less developed countries. I think we must continue to work in an international arrangement on big problems such as global climate change, endangered species, air, water, and land degradation, and also protection and sharing of germplasm. These are all things that really, I think, are critically important. We must work to seek to enhance international trade because that is one of the most important things that will enable this old world to survive into the future is if we can trade with each other in an effective way. And I'll say more about that a little bit later, I hope. And nations, particularly poor nations, must increase their commitment to supporting research and education in agriculture. And I can tell you that while more developed countries invest some 2 to 4% of the agricultural GDP in agricultural research, in African countries, averages less than 0.5%. And I can tell you, while it sounds tough for some of these poor countries to invest in research, the world can't do everything for everybody, and that's why they've got to invest in their own survival as well, and I think that's a very important point. Well, that brings up the key question. How do we bring about the next green revolution? We know about the first green revolution, and that's been well documented. Dr. Borlaug received the Nobel Prize for it. If I were to ask each of you to list what it would take to bring about the next green revolution, that is the question, and I'm going to share with you my thought or our thoughts on that. The first thing is the world has got to have a commitment to science, basic science, just pure science. That's important. It's the responsibility of science to develop the information, knowledge, and technology that will make the green revolution in the future happen. And what that does is provide the information that our leaders can use to make these kind of decisions. Dr. Borlaug clearly understood that science was a key part of agricultural policy to alleviate hunger in poor regions of the world, and I think that's important. And I was pleased that my two agricultural economists really bought into that idea that science was a part of agricultural policy, and I think it's a very important part. The critical and key question for us is, how do we go about creating that green revolution? First, I'd like to emphasize that all branches of science are involved, not just agronomy, not just animal science, but all of the sciences are very much involved. The first green revolution was based to a great extent on Dr. Borlaug's work using classical genetics and plant breeding techniques. But I can tell you in the future, the next green revolution will be greatly dependent upon genetically modified organisms. That's why I have little patience and little understanding of why some people are so resistant to using modern genetic techniques and doing the things that's got to be done. But let me just give you a few of the ideas that we came up with. Number one, converting C3 plants into C4 plants. Now that's one that has great, great potential for the many crops of the world. Number two is developing nitrogen fixation in non-legumes. Legumes do a beautiful job of fixing their own nitrogen, so you don't have to apply nitrogen to peanuts, to soybeans, to alfalfa, or any of the other legumes. Number three is incorporating the process of apomixis into crop plants. A tremendous boon if we could find a way to do that. The fourth is improving pest resistance in plants. While the BT gene has been very successful, I'm sure there's other ideas out there that would provide even greater pest control of different pests by using this approach. And finally, improving energy efficiency and nutrition efficiency in crop plants. These are also great potential areas that I think would lead to another green revolution. The one thing you probably recognize from all of these are extremely challenging scientific undertakings. These are not something you can walk into a lab one day and whip it out and write your paper next week. This is something that will take a lot of scientists. This perhaps is Nobel quality research in itself. So these are real challenging types of activities. Well, then the next logical question is, what is the commitment that we're making to bring about this next green revolution? We three authors agreed that this was probably the one thing we would like to say we were on track to do that, but unfortunately we are not. We're not even coming close to investing the kind of resources it would take to make these kinds of breakthroughs in agricultural research. The abundance of professional agricultural economic literature clearly shows there's a strong association between agricultural productivity improvements and agricultural research. That's a given. Given the unarguable linkage between research and agricultural productivity, it looks like that if we're concerned about our future, we would be making that kind of commitment today. There's an old saying in research that once you need the results, it's too late to start the experiment. And that's something that I wish everybody could understand. In addition to the increasing demand for food and energy in developing countries, developed countries are increasing their demands, as I mentioned earlier, because of greater expectations in quality of food, diversity of foods, and that sort of thing. There's a demand for increased environmental services in that, so there's a lot of demand out there, not just from developing countries, but from developed countries as well. Responding to the needs and expectations is not solely the responsibility of national leaders, legislative bodies, and others, but the public is going to have to actively support and become engaged in supporting our future. That might be a scary proposition in itself, but the public has got to be involved in such broad issues as global climate change, environmental regulations, welfare of animals, natural resource use and conservation, investments in agricultural research and education. So the public has a very defined role to play in the future of the people on this planet. The greatest concern felt by the authors of this paper is the apparent lack of commitment and appreciation and understanding of the long-term importance of basic agricultural research in meeting the needs and expectations of the people on this planet in the future. I'd like to acknowledge, though, that in the couple of recent budgets, there have been some very substantial increases in support for agricultural research in some quarters. But keep in mind, percentages increase on a very modest base doesn't get you very far very fast. And that's concerned. Also, this follows the fact that in the huge stimulus bill we had earlier last year, there was not a single penny in that stimulus package for programs in agricultural research. There were a few dollars for facilities in ARS, but no real money in the stimulus. So we're grateful for the increases because that's a step in the right direction. But I'm talking about major fundamental increases over an extended period of time. Keep in mind that the lag time between research and being able to have results is measured in decades, not next year. So it's important that the needs we have 20 or 30 or 40 years from now will be done by doing research starting today. So that gives some kind of urgency. I want to end with just a couple of facts that I don't think we can question. Our civilization for the future depends upon nourishing every human being on this planet. And I don't think anyone would argue with that. This country is certainly committed to that. We have spent untold billions of dollars over the years in different kinds of programs trying to help the people of the world. In the final analysis, this can be accomplished only by maintaining successful agricultural programs throughout the world. And the third and clinching fact is the success of this agriculture is almost totally dependent upon the information, knowledge, and technology that's gained through research. It's going to take a strong public commitment to ensure adequate funding to get these things done. Being an optimist, I'm hopeful and I'm confident that we will see the need for this kind of support for agriculture in the future. In fact, we have no choice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gail. We now have two discussants, Jonathan Bryant from BASF. Jonathan has been involved with Farm Foundation and our 30-year challenge project and some other projects as well, looking at these issues. And second, we have Johanna Nesseth from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Johanna is one of the leaders of their Global Food Security Project. So let's start. We'll go in the order down the table, and I'll let you start, Jonathan, and then Johanna can wrap it up, and we'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Neil. I wanted to pick up on a couple of the points that were brought up by Gail, particularly looking at the need for making the plant more effective. It always, to me, amazes me that you can take something as simple as a bit of dirt, a bit of water, a bit of sunshine, and through the amazing machinery of a seed, you can actually make something to feed the world. And as I look back at some of the papers that have been written by folks like the FAO and so forth, you can look at the gains we've made over the last decades. And, you know, land use, yes, we've increased land use. Yes, we've increased water use and irrigation and made some gains, but the majority of the gains that we've seen and been quite happy to report on have come from improvements in plants and how we use them. And I don't see any reason to believe that trend will be different going forward. I think the challenges that the paper has put before us are, as Gail said, quite immense. The technology that is being expected of us is indeed forefront. BASF and other companies are involved in that right now, and I can tell you it's an incredibly difficult challenge to improve a crop in the way that we are hoping to improve. It's quite easy to write down, oh, you know, we're going to double food production by 2050. But I think one message to leave you all with is, you know, that's an incredibly difficult challenge to do from improving plants. It's also challenging because it's so multifaceted. We wouldn't certainly rely upon plant improvement alone. I can tell you that by taking an improved plant in a greenhouse and saying, I've got it, it's there, eureka, you take it into a field and you go, ah, it doesn't actually work. So we are reminded daily that the challenge that we have to face here is indeed one of agronomy, physiology, soil science, irrigation, you name it. It will require a very multifaceted and deep and long-term look at making the improvements we need. We also mentioned some of the time lag issues, and I'll reinforce those. Again, my background, my focus at the moment is in GM plant improvement, specifically productivity improvements. And just to give you a simple sort of yardstick, if you will, if I had a technology, a gene today that I thought might give me yield improvement, I may see that in the marketplace in 15 years. It's a tremendously long-term commitment that we're making, which has many, many ramifications. It's almost a generational topic. The scientists I need to drive my 5, 10, 15-year programs are just going through high school today. You know, what will attract them to go through a program in the future that will give me the staff I need for a 10, 15, 20, 30-year engagement? The funding issue, there are certainly great commitments for the major crops, the corn, the soybeans. Big companies, private companies are certainly attacking the idea of productivity improvements in those crops with gusto and resource. But if you look at this as a world perspective, as I'm sure we're challenged to do, there's no doubt that many of the smaller crops will not get the attention, they will not get the resource that will be required to make a global improvement. So I think one of our challenges is looking at the issue of funding, looking at the issues of long-term commitment to enable not just the corn and soybean improvements that we all look for, but also the chickpea, the wheat, the other smaller crops perhaps that other countries, developing countries, depend upon. As I sat down this morning, I actually ended up by drawing a very simple matrix, a 2x2 matrix. And if you look at major crops and minor crops, you look at domestic and then Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa as your four dimensions. What became sort of clear to me is that we're going to need to do very different approaches to each of those four segments. Again, I think if I look at U.S. corn and soybeans, you know, we're already making some amazing improvements, and I think you'll see those over the next decade. There are programs that would take that, for example, out into Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia. A good example, I think, is a program called WEMA, the Water Efficient Maize in Agriculture, where technology develops in that sort of powerhouse of a U.S. corn, that existing intense machinery of private industry, taking that out into a developing country. Minor crops, even in a developed country, U.S., are essentially unattended to. The technologies that are being developed in, say, corn are not finding their way, and hence it's unlikely to see, at least in the short term, how we can get technology in, say, a chickpea out, through corn into a chickpea into a developing country. So as we look at this problem, it's not only a dimension of R&D commitment, difficulty, challenge, it's also a challenge, I think, of implementation, where we're going to need to think about a broad plan, a coordinated plan to get both of those. Didn't come up with a good acronym. It seemed like we're in the town of acronyms, but I didn't come up with a good acronym. But to me, the issues we're going to have to face are intention, coordination, funding and incentive, enablement, and risk management. Let me very, very briefly touch on what I mean by that. To me, the intention is one of citing the kind of broad goal that Gail and his team have put before us. There are too many silos, there are too many individual efforts to make this thing work in a way that doesn't have, as an umbrella, a broad strategic goal. Coordination. To me, that goal will have to bring together the interests of many, many parties. The private industry that has so many technologies, so many tools, so many already advancing R&D areas, brought together with academic institutions, brought together with NGOs, other funding agencies. So there's going to be a huge coordination effort that I see having to come together, because this is such a multifaceted problem, because it is so long-term, because implementation requires so many people. Funding and incentive, I think those are two very different things. The funding that's been challenged by many of the papers to bring forward the research initiative that Gail talks about is critical. But also making sure that we do this in a free market way. We have to leave incentives for all people to act. I don't think coordination will solve all our problems by any means, so having a free market system that makes sure the incentives are there for private and academic institutions to work would be critical. Enablement. Many times I've seen attempts that try to make cross-company, cross-function, cross-divisional initiatives work. They fail. They fail because of intellectual property. They fail because of issues of not having transparency of results in databases. I mean, just think, for example, I was talking to Gail beforehand. He and I come from a background of agricultural chemistry, when in the old days I could give a research compound to a university, some graduate students get to have a little bit of pocket money and do some work for us, and we get great data back. No questions, no problems. In the world that we're talking about, the world that we're describing now with GM crops, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because of more complex intellectual property, a regulated environment, a lot more risk of technology that is somehow, unfortunately, not used according to protocols. You name it, there's a thousand reasons why the enablement of these collaborations, of a broad-scale approach, open innovation, if you will, that has to be solved before this process can work. And I think that's the issue of risk management. if we are going to look at GM crop as one of the major tools, that brings with it a lot of risks for the reasons described, because it's a heavily regulated, because it's a technology that has some doubts and concerns, and companies and any institution with technology will be somewhat averse to freely and broadly utilizing that technology because of risk. So four or five nuts to crack: intention, coordination, funding, enablement, and risk. No small task.
Thank you, Jonathan. Johanna?
Great. Good morning, everyone. I have to start out by just letting you know, in case you hadn't figured it out already, I'm here from more of a foreign policy perspective. I have nowhere near the background that the co-discussants here have, so forgive me for my lack of detailed knowledge on ag research, but thanks for entertaining some of the thoughts that we've been going through at CSIS. I currently serve as Vice President for Strategic Planning at CSIS. I'm also leading our Food Security Task Force, and I'll give you a little bit of background about that. In a couple of years ago, CSIS led a major initiative looking at ways that the U.S. could rebuild our image abroad, tackling the issue of smart power. Rich Armitage and Joe Nye were our co-chairs. And when our commission came up with our five-pillar recommendations, one of those key pillars was development. The U.S. has to re-engage on development. On the heels of this report came the global food crisis, and we at CSIS said, you know, this is a really big issue. We need to take this on. We need to look at ways to re-elevate ag development, look at emergency assistance in a broader foreign policy context. And in July of 2008, Senators Casey and Lugar co-chaired a task force that we ran and put out recommendations for some of the near-term steps we could take to alleviate the global food crisis and some of the pinch that was being felt, especially in developing countries. Following on that, we wanted to look at the longer-term trends. So we've spent the past year looking at ag research and development and the agendas that relates to food security. We've looked at how to raise productivity, especially for smallholder farmers. And we've also been talking about international trade systems. It's been no small challenge, I'll tell you. Congresswoman McCollum joined the senators as one of our co-chairs, and we've really been talking about what CSIS can say about these issues. It's going to make a dent. And I'll tell you, I'm not an expert on these issues, but I'm really no stranger to agriculture, and I still find them very challenging to understand, very difficult to communicate. You can talk about the big, broad issues. You can talk about the challenges of feeding a world with a growing population. But when you get into the weeds, when you start talking about these really complicated technology problems, it's very difficult to understand. I grew up on a farm. I spent 10 years in 4-H. I showed pigs, I showed sheep, I went to a land-grant university, I worked for 4-H on the state and local levels. I know a lot about ag, and I still have just been bending my brain for the past year to understand how you talk about these things and how you understand these different components of agriculture. And one of the impressions that I've really been left with very strongly is the incredible approach that the U.S. has had. It's taken over 100 years. But in the same way as our highway systems work, as our public school systems work, extension and farming works in a very similar way. You've got a very dispersed group of people who are all reading the same publications, who are learning about the same stuff, who are using the same crops and sharing ideas that feed into new technology developments. This doesn't exist everywhere, and I think it's really one of the most promising and positive aspects of U.S. agriculture, and one that's really it's really something to be proud of and to talk about and to use in our international and foreign policy efforts. One of the piece that we've been doing on R&D, we've had a report that we've commissioned, a public paper. It was by Phil Party and Julian Alston. This is on our website, and we just put it out a couple weeks ago, and it really talks about ag research in a food security setting. So as we think about some of the things we have to tackle in order to help to alleviate poverty in poor countries, to raise food security for people, these are big long-term questions. Emergency assistance, I think, is a fairly compelling case to make. There's a lot of money that's been put toward emergency assistance, but it doesn't make sense to just keep putting money toward emergency assistance. So how do you make the case for these really long-term investments? And R&D is, of course, the longest term possible. Phil and Julian Alston of UC Davis co-authored this report to get to the core of some of the questions around the R&D agenda as it relates to increasing food security. I'm going to run through some of the issues that they raised. Not all of these will appear in our report. We also had a couple of task force meetings. Jonathan shared with us some of his ideas. We've heard from seed developers in India and other places who've helped give us some food for thought as we come up with our recommendations. So Phil and Julian have made the case that, of course, R&D improves productivity. Productivity and food security are linked. You've got it in two places. You've got, you know, rising productivity in high-producing countries can be exported, feeding a lot more people. You want to also raise productivity among poor farmers so that they can feed themselves and have greater economic opportunity. But also that these are long-term investments. Continued investment is required to just keep up with where we are now. If you want to get ahead, you've got to make even larger investments. There's been a significant slowdown in funding for R&D, especially related to food and feed, as priorities have shifted to energy and environmental priorities in other areas of agriculture. The U.S. is a really important leader in R&D. The rest of the world, though, is gaining ground. China and India's investments in 2000 accounted for nearly 30% of all public R&D. Sub-Saharan Africa's investments have dropped to about 12% in 2000. And Phil and Julian talk about the fact that the private sector plays such an important role, and I think here is where we really get to our big questions that we've been tackling. How do you get the public and private sectors together? How do you develop a strategy for R&D as it relates to food security? And how do you get that long-term commitment from policymakers who right now are nervous about November, and then they're going to be nervous about November 2012 and then 2014? So getting buy-in is really important. Some of the suggestions they've made include, and these aren't all going to be probably the most practical, but they've put them out there for thought. They've included, of course, increasing investments in R&D, finding new ways to pay for research, including co-financing by the government and agribusiness and farmers for research relevant to their sectors, using creative co-financing for international initiatives through the CG system and others. Some of the points, you can read this, take a look, and see what you think. Some of the points that we've pulled out of there and all of our discussions that we'll be talking about more broadly when we roll out our report in a couple of months include some things that are probably pretty basic to this audience, but I think, as I said, aren't necessarily the most obvious things to everyone who's dealing with Afghanistan and Iraq and all of the other foreign policy and economic priorities. The first piece is that you got to make the case. I think everyone here has talked about communication, communicating the importance of R&D, communicating it in ways that are really compelling. You've got this dramatic case to be made about the incredible growth in medical research versus the really stagnant growth in agricultural research. And there are both interesting stories to tell about medical research. You can talk about saving lives. You can talk about our advanced medical system. I think people take for granted, as you all know, that food is just there. In the U.S., food is so cheap, it's so easy, and it's so taken for granted that people don't think about it a lot. But talking about this is important. Showing success, we think, is important. IFPRI's got a new publication out, or relatively new publication out, talking about some of the really successful programs that have raised productivity that have been very effective, everything from dairy production to plant production and to some animal farming techniques. And talking about some of those positive developments, I think is very powerful because it's just a powerful case for the U.S. to talk about feeding the world. Americans like to do it. You get congressmen and senators who also like to talk about it and can make the case to their constituents. I've told a couple people about my experience over the holidays. I was home in Minnesota at my parents' farm, and my dad has, like, I don't know, 30 ag publications lying around the house. He subscribes to everything. He has Beyond the Bean, the Soybean Checkoff publication. He's got everything. And I was reading it, and it brought home to me this real divide between the domestic producers who look at USDA as a domestic agency. It's there to help them increase production, export, and to really improve what they're doing. And you've got an international approach now with a relatively large new food security initiative, a $3.35 billion initiative, And it just struck me the level of tension between domestic producers in this, and the folks who are interested in this big international initiative. And how you bring those two communities together, I think, is important. I'm sure my hometown was a little bit unusual, but we had several returned Peace Corps volunteers who were interested in international development, interested in doing this kind of work, and I think communicating more with domestic producers is going to be important. On R&D specifically, we looked at a couple of pieces, and we're looking at a couple of pieces. One is obviously that investments should increase. They should be more competitive. New investments within, especially the Food Security Initiative and that pot of funds, any investments on R&D should be competitively awarded. That we should really root a lot of our efforts in the CG system, and that the CG system, new funds that we provide should likely be targeted to core staple food crops. That we should look at the land-grant universities as storehouses of great knowledge and skill to train the next generation of developing country scientists. You all know that every scientist you meet has graduated from Purdue or from Michigan or from Minnesota, and I think it's a real source of pride that we should really rebuild. And then finally, we talk about really improving public-private discussions. And this is something we've got to talk to Jonathan more about, because when we get to the question of, okay, exactly how you do that, well, we should have a public-private working group. We should talk about the IPR issues. We should talk about some of the liability issues. But how we actually go about doing that, we've still got to get some granularity on, because it's very, very difficult. And I think the final piece on R&D is looking at African regulatory systems around biotechnology. We have a pretty diverse group of people involved in our task force, folks who have been very involved in development, involved in Africa, involved around the world in agriculture, and they tend to be quite consistent in their belief that you have to have biotechnology on the table. But we've done some analysis in Africa to find out, okay, where are some of these regulatory systems, where is public opinion? And it's obvious that we're going to have to walk a fine line, because probably the approach to take is to work with countries that decide to use biotechnology in developing regulatory systems, science-based systems, and take it step by step. But as we talk about the importance of biotechnology, in the U.S., it's a powerhouse, and we can use it very effectively. But in developing countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, it's going to be a slow process. Just two more pieces beyond research and development. We are talking some about trade and the need to really revitalize trade as a foreign policy tool, and then ways to increase productivity by focusing on infrastructures and systems, obviously inputs, and embedding natural resource management and reaching out to women farmers in U.S. efforts. So that's sort of a broad overview. I'll mention also, on March 1st, we're going to be hosting a meeting in collaboration with the International Fertilizer and Development Center, Syngenta, and the Partnership to Cut Hunger. We're going to be talking about input sector research, extension, and investment, so taking this discussion forward. But that's a quick overview of what we're doing and where we're headed on the research discussion. And appreciate the CAST paper, because I think it gives us a lot of the background and the detail that we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Johanna. Let's give the entire panel a round of applause. Now it's your turn. And for those of you who've been here before, I warn you, I'm not as entertaining as Charlie Stenholm. So I'm counting on you to provide us with some stimulation and get some conversation started. Yeah, Clay, would you mind stepping up to the microphone so that we can capture this on tape? Thanks.
Well, according to people who study these things, the price of food is really determined now by the price of oil. If the price of oil doubles, the price of major commodities will also double. So that's, and then all of our climate policies, the most popular alternatives worldwide have been to prevent the destruction of forests as a way of reducing greenhouse gases. So that again reduces the expansion of agriculture and has an effect on food prices. The carbon trading, the whole idea is, you know, you raise the price of energy, and that, that's part of the way it works. And again, I just said there's a link between energy and food prices. The studies are showing that the least costly way under current scoring for reducing greenhouse gases is to take land that's currently in crops and plant it to trees, and that creates a sink and takes carbon out of the atmosphere. So that, under current scoring, that could have a major impact on food prices, as if the world, you know, agreed to go forward with what their, you know, the approach that's being. So it seems to me that, you know, the policy issues that would affect food prices over the next 30 years while all this research is taking place, there's a lot of very pressing issues that you folks chose not to include in your discussions about this. But, you know, if you're concerned about hunger now, it seems to me that these issues are really need to be at the forefront rather than, you know, left out of the discussion.
Okay. Gail, why don't you start? The what about the short term?
Well, there's no question that we should be concerned about hunger today, but the purpose of our paper was to really look into the future and start planning, and that's why research is so important. We're still not doing everything we know today in all countries around the world. I mean, else why would there be such a hue and cry against genetically modified organisms in some parts of the world? And of course, I understand that in some countries in Africa, they actually would not use corn because it was from the U.S. and it had been genetically modified. And of course, I doubt if as American in this country that is not eating genetically modified food. I don't know how you would go about having a meal and not having something genetically modified today, because you can't have a meal hardly without having corn or soybeans or potatoes or crops that are genetically modified. So there's a lot of things we're not doing today, but our purpose in this paper was to really look into the future. What's going to happen 30, 40, 50 years from now? And of course, this was a vision that Dr. Borlaug had. Keep in mind, he was a visionary as well as a great scientist and a humanitarian. And his ideas was to do what he could today using classical genetics. But I don't think there was anyone any more supportive of biotechnology than Dr. Borlaug, because as new techniques developed, he was very much in support of looking at any techniques that would help him achieve his goals of food security.
Jonathan, any observations?
Just maybe one. There's no doubt that there are a lot of confounding factors and forces here. The concern I would only have is that we must be careful not to be paralyzed by that complexity. One thing that I sort of get up every morning with is the fact that at the end of the day, I don't think there's going to be a limit to what we can use agricultural production for. And at least for the theme of productivity per se, I think that is a fundamental need. You're right, no doubt, that there'll be a lot of confounding forces and factors here on pricing, utilization, you know, so forth. But I've not heard a single argument, providing it's done in a way that's sustainable, that we shouldn't be targeting for increased productivity. So I'm agreeing, but I'm also saying let's make sure we don't lose the a focus on a fundamental like productivity.
Johanna, you're okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Surely there must be another question out there somewhere. Yes. Could you... Kristen, I'm sorry, could you use the mic, please? I wish we had more to pass around, but we're tethered here.
It's refining a little more on the earlier theme. I'd be very interested in hearing from you if you have any strategies regarding how to address the resistance in Africa on the biotechnology issue. In a lot of cases, it's not a philosophical issue like it is with Europe. In fact, what we've been told in many cases is the concern about being able to trade with Europe. And if you have some strategies, I'd be very interested to hear that.
Okay.
I think what we've looked at to a degree is a very go-slow approach, a very light-footed approach. Our sense in conducting interviews was that the more the U.S. pushes or puts it out as a priority, the more resistance there will be. So providing technical assistance, reviews of regulatory systems, and assistance in developing new regulatory science-based structures are important. Having a strong, well-respected scientific community is important, so making efforts in that direction, but a very soft-footed approach, I think, is our bottom line in terms of what actually can be most useful and most accepted.
Jonathan? Gail, any comments on that one? Okay, thank you, Johanna. Come on, I'm looking for the next one.
Good morning, I'm Bob St. Peter with the National Family Farm Coalition. I'm not a scientist, but I am a farmer, so that makes me a researcher. I do research all the time. And I just want to offer my observations from the last 4 or 5 years on my own farm. My wife and I have been able to produce all of our own fruits and vegetables and culinary medicinal herbs on about a tenth of an acre. We grow more than 50 varieties of 50 different crops that we use. And we do all this with compost, essentially, a little bit of wood ash that we produce from our wood stove. So we've been able to maintain fertility, increase production, basically by using what we have available to us. And from my conversations with other subsistence farmers around the world, this is what they need most, which is access to land and to the resources that they have available to them already. So that's my observation. My question is, I guess, about the next green revolution. The promises, the principal promises, I understand it, of the first green revolution is that we're going to increase productivity and feed the world. And certainly, as it applies to certain commodity crops, production, no question, has been increased through the roof. But we still have 1 billion people who are hungry, and we have 1 billion people who are overfed. We have massive soil degradation. And I've been to the Yaqui Valley recently in Mexico, where Dr. Borlaugs did his first tests, and the soil there is destroyed. It's so compacted that you can pick it up in blocks. There's no organic matter. And from my understanding of farming, that's because there hasn't been the giving back to the soil, compost and organic matter and what have you, and instead they've used chemical inputs. And the result has been devastating to this valley, and I encourage you all to go see it. So, and the other key problem, I think, is the migration of people from rural communities into our urban areas, which are creating enormous social problems. And this is a result of people not being able to make a living on the land and feed themselves. So my question is, what assurances do we have that the next 60 years are going to produce better results than the first 60 years? Thank you.
Okay. Panel?
Well, of course, in feeding the world's people, it takes a lot of food. And, of course, the idea of each person growing their own and small plots of land is an ideal, and certainly I commend you for that. But in providing enough food for the 9 billion people, providing enough food for the 7 billion that's on the planet today really requires a very sophisticated way of producing food. And I know it's important to look at all aspects, but and there are some degradation of soil, as I mentioned. That's something we should be concerned about, but there's a lot of soil that's improved. In fact, I can tell you that in many places, the soils today are much better than they were in the past. Soils don't have to be degraded to produce agriculture. I mean, I think we know that pretty. But it takes a lot of understanding and appreciation and education of farmers and others. So it's a challenge, but I think that we've got to be concerned about how do we produce adequate food for the 9 billion souls, and how do we improve the diet of those other. You know, today there's over 1 billion people on this planet that don't get adequate food in the way of calories. There's another 1 billion that don't get adequate protein and nutrients and minerals and that sort of thing today. So we still have challenges today. But I think we have to look at the most effective way we can produce food, and that's a real challenge for us.
Jonathan?
I think the goal, the general goal of doing what we need to do in round 2 of Green Revolution, doing it sustainably, is a a goal that we can all live up to. I think the some of the technologies we've talked about this morning are going to be geared at doing more with less, be it drought tolerance, be it nitrogen use efficiency in corn or phosphorus. I think you're going to see a lot of things that will be developed as a natural course of improving yield and that natural course of this broad goal that will fit within a sort of a generation 2.0 of green revolution and fit some of your general goals. I mean, there's no doubt that, as I said at the beginning of my comments, that I think the holistic look at production is going to be very, very important and won't go away. You know, we're not talking about a one-shot silver bullet here. Soil water use in general, but I think you can be able to look at what we're going to do with plant productivity in the frame of sustainability in a very good and broad way.
I mean, I think it's a real conundrum because you can raise productivity probably most dramatically in areas that are already productive in the U.S. and in Brazil and other places, but at the same time you've got these very poor farmers who just need to make a living in the place where they are. And I think looking at what the U.S. policy approach is in terms of ag development, having soil systems and innovation systems and educational efforts to help people to take care of the land and take care of natural resources is going to be should be a primary goal. But they're two very different things, and I sometimes get almost paralyzed thinking about, my gosh, how do you take on all of this? But I think looking at them in two different ways is probably one of the ways to tackle it most practically.
I'd like to comment, make one further comment. We gave a presentation at the State Department a week ago, and that question came up, and of course, you know, in essence, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the leaders of this country when we got in the beginning, because it was recognized by some of our leaders that the way to build a country was to develop ways to grow something or build something, which is in essence how you develop an economy. And clearly I think that's exactly how we're going to have to deal with a lot of other countries. We got to help them learn how to build something or grow something, and how do you do it in a sustainable way, and that I think is the heart of the challenge we have. You're right, it's a tremendous undertaking to look at a poor country and see how do you build that infrastructure. It sounds easy to say, it kind of rolls off the tongue, build infrastructure, but building all of these things that enables a society to be productive is not an easy task. But thank goodness we had some folks that realized a land-grant university was a way to do some of these sorts of things in agriculture and engineering, which was basic. But I think that's some of the lessons we need to be remembering as we try to help other people around the world develop their food. Also, is another point that I like to make, and that is, not necessarily does all countries need to grow food. They need to grow whatever they can grow more effectively and more efficiently. For example, in some of the countries in the tropics could grow energy if we develop the technology. And if you could grow energy and make more dollars or more value for it, and then you could buy food from somebody that grows food more efficiently. So it's we got to think of agricultural output in a holistic way. What is a value? Because if you've got effective international trade so countries can trade everything, maybe a country that doesn't have any food can grow energy more efficiently. So let them grow food. I mean, let them grow energy and trade it for food.
Okay. Another question. Okay, good.
Sam Willett with the National Corn Growers Association, and as you might imagine, we are great supporters of trying to encourage more investment in agricultural research. One of the questions that we deal with, even in our own association, I know other associations deal with, as with the new Farm Bill, it encourages a competitive grant process. But we still see these pressures within land grants and other organizations for earmarks. How well do you think over time our land grants, which have a tremendous amount of talent and skill, are going to adapt to that new competitive environment as opposed to ones that we've been more comfortable with and try and approach Congress for earmark requests?
Okay. Gail, you're no longer a dean and no longer an undersecretary.
I no longer have a job, so I can say anything. Well, of course, I have been engaged in this formula funding versus competitive grants throughout my life, as well as earmarks. So I'm very familiar with the mechanisms. And while this was not a point of the paper that we've written, I'll give you my personal feelings, and I hope my co-authors will yield me that opportunity. And while the different funding mechanisms, the funding mechanism for formula came about in 1887 with Senator Hatch, which the Hatch Act, and that has served us well. But then, since World War II, as new types of the universities started clamoring for funds, the formula-type funds fell into somewhat disrepute among scientists. Not among the ag community, not among universities, but among other sciences. And so the formula became a method of funding, and that has some advantages and has some, it's easy for the bean counters to keep up with things, so it has some merit. But I would like to think that maybe we would have some more creative ways of funding the big issues in agricultural research in the future. And I have some ideas, but I won't say them publicly because they might be stupid. But I really think that we need to be thinking creatively about how do we fund the needs in agricultural research that's going to do us good 30 or 40 years from now. So those are some real challenges. In other words, what is the best way to do research? And of course, I can tell you that having been a dean for many years and experimentation director, I can make a case for the formula about as good as anybody, I think. But I can also, having been in Washington, know how OMB thinks and how this community thinks and how other science communities think. The competitive grant is the way to go. So, but I think there's something new that we ought to be developing and thinking about.
Okay. Maybe we'll have to do a forum on something new. The rest of the panel, any responses on that question? Okay.
I need to add one more comment to that. While I was an active weed scientist, I visited a number of industry laboratories around the world. I visited yours in Germany, I visited Switzerland, I visited Lanco and Dow and all of the ones in the U.S. And I used to marvel at how industry funded research. I think that that we need to be doing exactly as you said, developing those ties we used to have with industry more effectively, because that's been one of the strengths of the agriculture, has been the close tie between industry and academia. And so maybe that's something else we want to look at.
Okay. All right. There we go.
I'm Ed Mikes, and I do the Kiplinger Agriculture Letter. I am really interested in the thing Johanna brought up, and you've mentioned, I guess all of you in some ways, the kind of conflict between funding help with research and development in food poor countries around the world versus funding, you know, the things we need in the U.S. You know, I think everybody likes the idea of helping those, and they need, you know, help developing their science and developing their infrastructure. But members of Congress, when they have to decide between funding my farmers who need how to figure out what to do with barley rust, or need to figure out what we're going to do with citrus greening in a citrus area, that's what's going to get funded, you know. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the things that you just sort of brought up. Is what do we do with research and development in the future that maybe, you know, gets around that huge conflict, or somehow finds a better way to do the things internationally that we need to do, and still keeps the people at home happy.
That's my okay. Question. Good question. Okay. Johanna?
It is a challenge, and I think it's a challenge where leadership is really important. I think that the administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration before, played a great role in saying, look, this is important. We've got to deal with food security. We've got to deal with all this big global food crisis. So you have to have leadership to start pushing things through. no matter what. And I know Secretary Vilsack has gotten a lot of criticism about some of the international efforts, but I think having strong leaders to just do it no matter what is important. But in the face of that, then you have to give congressmen an ability and the tools to make the argument. Some of the things I think, and I'm going to say what Neela wanted me to talk about in the first place, some of the ways we're thinking about that you make the argument broadly are to talk about the security challenges. It's important to have stability on the ground in different countries. Otherwise, you're throwing money after emergencies. You're throwing money at development that's going to crumble when instability happens, and it just makes good economic sense. Another argument is that this, you know, ag development, international research is what's really, really useful to pull places out of poverty. It's what countries really need. It's what they're asking for. It's the core of so many poor countries' economies that it just makes good sense. But beyond that, I think that there's a good case at home to make in terms of spillover effects of research that's done in international systems and international programs can be used for U.S. crops and in U.S. institutions for new discoveries and new things are going to be helpful to U.S. farmers. And that is better value for your dollar because you get to use it eventually. And talking about some of the connections between the public and private sector and pulling in private foundations, which especially the Gates Foundation and Rockefeller, who are having a huge impact, you create these synergies that can be very helpful at home and that can also raise, if you invest in trading systems and economic systems and regulatory systems, you're going to have a greater and more effective market for U.S. crops in the future. So I think trying to put forward some really strong leadership to just bust down some walls and make some statements, but then following up with some really important arguments about why this can help you at home is hopefully an effective approach.
Okay.
I totally agree. I think the example we mentioned earlier, there's the African Agricultural Task Force, which has worked with this WEMA, Water Efficient Maize. I think it's a nice example. It's Warren Buffett, it's Bill Gates, Melinda Gates Foundation. It's technology from a private industry, BSF and Monsanto's drought technology. It's a great example. We're not looking at a $100 million research facility to be built in Africa. It's really about enablement. And whether it's taking students into our system or whether it's taking technology, as you say, spillover almost, it's technology that we are developing for a main cause and putting it out into a secondary opportunity. I don't think this is resource limiting. It's intention limiting. It's leadership limiting. And I think we could do a lot more of that.
Okay. Gail?
Yeah, I would like to comment. Certainly, dealing with immediate problems is who asked the question? Oh, there, yeah. Dealing with immediate problems is important, but and for example, you mentioned citrus greening. A real challenge, if we don't whip that problem, we could see some serious problems happening with our citrus industry in this country. It's already in Florida, all over the citrus area. It's now in Texas. California still hadn't got it yet, but they got the silas bug, which transmits it, so it's a matter of time till they get it in California. That's just one, but there's many of these kind of issues. Look at if you heard of UG99 wheat stem rust, a major, major challenge. It's already up to Egypt now. It's going to get into the rest of the Mideast, and then eventually it'll probably get to this country. Hopefully by that time, we will have developed some of our cultivars of wheat that will withstand wheat stem rust. But these are the immediate things that you can't overlook. These are critical issues we must continue the research effort on at the present time. 1974, remember the problem we had concern with corn? And of course, that scared us to death for a few months till we find a way to get around the problem. So there's a lot of these kind of issues that are challenges today that we can't overlook. But we also need to not spend all of our eggs in that basket. We need to be thinking about the long-range future as well.
I'll just add to that. You know, one of the things that we've talked about is how do you put forward some quick-ish wins? How do you demonstrate success in some things like UG99 and other areas that people can look at, they can realize the applicability at home, they can understand the effect of it, and it can kind of carry you into longer-term efforts. Because just putting out a big, long 20-year goal is going to not inspire. It's just not going to be as inspiring as saying we have an urgent, immediate threat right now. We're working on it. We're showing some progress. It's you know, UG99 is spreading. It can come to the U.S. We've got to tackle it now. Tackling some of those big current issues, I think, can be pretty compelling as well.
Okay.
My name is Don Ferguson. I will, for this purpose of this audience, I'll describe myself as USDA retired.
That's good.
And I do have quite a bit of experience working internationally, particularly in low-income countries of Africa. Now, I think in this kind of an audience, you almost always focus upon what I would call high-tech research. And I think that there is a real, real need also to focus on what I'll call low-tech research, and that is what farmers can do, should be doing, in their low-income country situation. What you need to better manage the soils, the crop rotations, these sorts of questions and issues, which I think, particularly this crop rotations, adding new crops, are very much important for the increase in yields, a total productivity per unit area that you find around the world. So I would put in an argument for putting some emphasis on what I'll call low-tech research. Second point is I think that the single program of the Department of Agriculture Extension Service, which is most valuable, is teaching farmers how to be better managers, how to put together a farm management plan, how to borrow money, how to all these sorts of things. And I think that, again, you can call that low-tech if you like, but I think that is the kinds of things that you may need some additional attention.
Okay, Don. All right. How about low-tech research?
Well, I certainly would agree with you, and that's part of the visionary approach that the leaders of our country took 100 years ago. The creation of the land-grant university, the creation of the experiment station, and certainly quickly following the creation of the extension service, because information, knowledge, and technology does little good unless it's delivered to where you can use it. And that's the role of the Extension Service. So certainly I would be very supportive of that aspect of helping countries, and including our own as well. And of course, there's some deep concern in this country about the extension. Do we have the support that we really need? I know a lot of countries, a lot of states are using different approaches, and if they work, I support them. But that means of taking information directed to people that can use it is a critical part of the process.
Others?
No question from my side. I think the, in many respects, what you're describing as low tech is fundamental tech, because if we can't make that basic land productive, you can make all the improvements to the crop you want, and you probably won't get your money's worth out. So, to me, what you describe is sort of step one, phase one, make it productive, and then I think you can get the real benefits of the other improvements we talked about, medium, long term.
Yeah, I think that's where our international efforts are going to, in part, be focused in the new initiative, and that goes to your point, too, about the poor soil in Mexico.
Okay. More questions. I don't do entertaining monologues. All right. While I'm waiting, oh, good. Okay, I was going to say, I do have a couple of questions in reserve, but I want yours first.
Well, I'm Trevor Warren. I'm a student at Texas A&M. My question goes back to, I guess, private industry and intellectual property. Y'all had referred to how it would be important to, once again, establish a relationship with private industry. And so going to intellectual property rights and protecting that, I'll give an example. I think it's Monsanto that develops, or at least owns, the rights to Roundup Ready cotton seeds. And in the U.S., you have to return your seeds, or you can't use them to plant the next year. Monsanto now sells those same seeds in, I think, Brazil it is, and they're having a problem with those seeds being used again in the next year. So in order for a company to be encouraged to develop new technologies, it seems to me that we have to establish a way to protect those technologies so they get a return on their investment. So do you all have any ideas on how we might better be able to protect those technologies?
Intellectual property rights. Jonathan, you mentioned that in your original presentation. How about a little follow-up?
So a couple of points, I think. You know, the bedrock of innovation is some degree of compensation that comes with that, and the patent system is a wonderful job of creating that bedrock. So to some countries, that alone is sufficient to enable a value capture, and you're absolutely right. The incentive I talked about earlier to invest, the incentive for things like $100+ million to develop a new GM crop is very important to feel at the end of the day there's a way to recover value. Some crops are naturally, if you like, value protected. I mean, corn being a hybrid, if you don't save seed in hybrids, we've known that way before GM came along. Other crops, for example, wheat, for example, it probably will see some differences in how GM is deployed because the crop itself is not it's not sort of offering that same protections, and some countries won't have the intellectual property rigors that make it an attractive target. So having ways to protect and capture value is an important incentive for the investments that are ahead of us. There are multiple ways to achieve that. There are no simple solutions. Some of the crops, some of the patenting environment that have to be developed enough to want to lay out investment.
But do you have any specific ideas?
From a technology point of view? Are you talking about a technology that would lend itself to intellectual property? Nope.
Other comments from the panel? Okay. Jim.
Jim Fisher. I once was told by an economist that selling is trying to get rid of something you got too much of, and marketing is convincing people you got something they need. As I think about what I hear here today about lack of funding, collaboration, coordination, and such, I recall several years ago when NIH came forward with their major initiatives and said they were going to cure cancer in a certain number of years and doubled their budget. I look at the Department of Energy today that has projections on when we're quote unquote going to have peak oil or when we're going to, and what's happening in their budget. How do you put what you are saying in something that will, you can market, or if you will, quite simply, become sexy?
Okay, Gail, you talked about how do we get that strong commitment. I think that Jim has put that question back on the table.
Well, it's a challenging question, and no doubt a lot of us has been involved in ag research for some 40 years, either as a bench scientist or as an administrator, have often lamented that we have difficulty in making our case. We haven't made it very well. And this is why when I had the opportunity to chair this writing group to write on this topic, and someone over here mentioned the difficulty of this kind of visionary look at agriculture research, I jumped at it because I think it's important that we do a more effective job of convincing people. You know, and the first thing we have to do is convince people that the bounty that we enjoy from agriculture is not a given. It's still a challenge. Some of the things we just talked about, and there are many of these kind of things, and how do we ensure that this happens for the future? How do we ensure that all the people on the planet get everything that they need today? So it's a real challenge, and I'm not sure that I know how to make that case. I know that we've watched some other federal agencies that have done a great job of communicating so that they have strong support from the population, they have strong support from the Congress to improve their funding. But I think that we've got to do a more effective job of telling our story for the future, and certainly solving today's problems that affect agriculture is critically important, but it's just as important we think about the future. And I wish I had a good answer to the question, but I don't.
The Maybe rest these of the guys panel? Do. Jonathan, Johanna?
Some people would say feeding the world is sexy enough. I would hope that that's emotional enough to capture the attention of our government and coordinate and sort of gel a single vision. I think it's something that has raised the attention and is getting the attention it deserves. Whether we can coalesce that into a single objective is our challenge.
I think this is our job at CSIS, is kind of making this case in a new and compelling way, and one that reaches beyond a sort of traditional, more agricultural development community. Look, I think that we've started by talking about what's the current status of research and development. Why does it need a change? And there were some really important changes made in the Farm Bill. There were a lot of producers groups behind them. This is significant. There's a lot of reform going on in the CG system. Hopefully it'll work out and make some progress. So talking about what's up with the system, how can it change? Is there an ability to change? And the fact that there's change in the works is important, I think, especially for congressmen who may look at the system and think, yeah, well, you guys are kind of stuck in the past. Are you really committed? But so making the case that, look, we've got some important movement here. Then talk about some of the threats. You know, we at CSIS talk about threats a lot, but what are the threats of not investing in research? What are the threats of UG99? What are the threats of different kinds of diseases and droughts and other problems? And I think that's a very compelling story. But then we have to talk about the opportunities, and research affords some really incredible opportunities. And at the core, Americans are very proud and confident. Americans are proud that they have a role in feeding the world. They're proud that we provide more emergency assistance than any other country in the world. And they're very, very proud and confident in technology. Americans believe in technology. We like it. We buy it. We think it's great. So harnessing some of those sentiments, I think, can make a really compelling case. And you might say, well, we should do sort of a man on the moon or cure cancer kind of effort. I'm not sure that that's the best way to go about it, to say we're going to solve hunger in 20 years, because it's a lot more than research that you need to solve hunger. It's access and markets and infrastructure and everything else. But putting out a really big, bright, bold idea and getting leadership behind it, I think, could have a really could play a really important role.
Tom.
Morning, Neil. Tom Hebert. Relative to this discussion, I think the challenge in part comes from, and I mean this in no disrespect whatsoever, because I appreciate very much what everyone's trying to do, but it seems like the people that are voicing these concerns the most out of the research community, out of the commercial community, out of the NGO community, are the ones that will happen to also see their research budgets increase, see their NGO budgets increase, see commercial opportunities increase. And that's not a bad thing, because you're doing great work, believe me. But there's an inherent skepticism to listening to the message from such messengers. And I'm a lobbyist, so I know all about people being skeptical about you. But who are the voices that you know of that are starting to talk about this that would transcend that kind of challenge? I know Bill Gates came close to it in the speech he gave at the Borlaug event in Iowa several months ago. His speech didn't go all the way there, but it came pretty close. Who are the voices out there that you all are hearing that would probably have more credibility, because they would transcend the more immediate self-interest of the organizations that you all are working with?
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Well, I certainly want to respond, and of course you're right in that. But then my writing team, including Luther and Bob and I, are all retirees, so we have no interest in getting any more funding for our research, because we're finished. So I think we are concerned about a bigger picture for the long term. But I'm not sure that there's really, well, for example, and I think I'm correct, and I believe that the Gates Foundation is supporting some research in Erie on rice, looking at C3, C4, because rice is one of the major crops in the world. It's a C3 plant. So what could we do if we converted that plant to a C4 plant? So that's the kind of visionary thinking that you won't get with the formula funds. You won't get with a specific competitive grant over 2 years or 3 years or 5 years at most. So maybe we need to be doing some more visionary thinking, and it's fortunate that someone such as the Gates Foundation is doing this kind of support. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that, and this was one of the things that Dr. Borlaug was most emphatic about, is the public has a role to play. And it's been interesting because I've watched, I used some terms that I was just knew I'd get a couple of questions. For example, the C3, C4, nobody asked a question
yeah,
about
yeah,
that.
What is a C3
nobody
and a C4 plant?
Nobody asked a question about apomixis. Nobody has really asked a question about some of the other things. Or what about energy efficiency of plants? Nobody asked a question about that. So some of the things that I thought was really heart and soul of this issue are the ones he's asked a question about.
Jonathan? Johanna?
I'd like to think that CSIS has a small role to play because we don't really do development. We've certainly never done anything in agriculture. So our goal in talking about this is to say, look, this needs to be a priority. It's important beyond just the traditional ag and development communities. I think Secretary Gates plays a great role in talking about development as a priority for defense and for keeping stability in countries. I think that your point about developing new champions is right on. Getting congressional leaders to talk about it, congressional leaders from farm states, Senator Lugar and Senator Casey are both great. Congresswoman McCollum has been a great champion and others. But finding new congressmen and new senators who take this on as an issue that they care about is a priority. And getting other thought leaders. I don't know if you all know, if anyone here knows who Tony Cordesman is. He's a scholar at CSIS. He's just a hardcore defense, oil, and security analyst. And he has put out a great deal of analysis about Afghanistan, and he spent a month with General McChrystal. He made the most compelling case for agriculture in Afghanistan I've ever heard. I had no idea he studied Afghanistan from that perspective. But getting people who care about other things to say, look, this is important, and we've got to really focus on it. He talked about dams. He talked about irrigation systems. He talked about markets and infrastructure, all the same things that Oxfam or CARE would talk about, but in a totally different way and with a totally different voice. And getting new champions, I think, is key. And I think there are a lot of people out there who do care about it, so bringing them forward and getting them to talk about it. Rich Armitage. Rich Armitage talks about this stuff in the most unusual way because he's enormous and big and beefy, and he says, I am no humanitarian, but let me tell you, this is important. So getting more voices like that are prominent, they're out there, they're talking about it, some of them, and just tapping into them and bringing them forward more, I think is not all that difficult to do, and we're starting to see that happen.
Okay, Anita.
I'm Anita Regmi from USDA, and I wanted to follow up with you. I thought I might look too dumb if I asked what C3, C4, and what upper mixes were, but if you could care to explain, I'd appreciate that.
What was the question?
The C3 and C4 plants. Anita was a little reluctant to ask that question, even though she had it on the top of her mind.
You were going to ask
that
anyway.
She thought all the rest of us knew, too.
First place, plants have different mechanisms of photosynthesis. Of course, photosynthesis is a wonderful process, been going on for millions of years. It's a way to fix carbon, taking CO2 from the atmosphere and fixing it into an organic material. And there's three types, but I won't mention the third because it's kind of incidental. But the two main types of photosynthesis is C3, in which the first product of photosynthesis is a three-carbon fragment, 3-phosphoglyceric acid. That's the first process. The second type of photosynthesis is the first product of photosynthesis is a 4-carbon, an oxaloacetate. And those are the two types, and that's where you get the C3 and C4. Now, why C4 is more efficient and more effective? Well, it has the process of when it fixes carbon, it stays fixed, whereas the C3 photosynthesis has a lot of photorespiration at night in which a lot of the fixed carbon is unfixed. So you lose some of the fixed carbon that's fixed during the day, you lose it at night, so it's not as efficient as the C4 because once it's fixed as a 4-carbon fragment, it stays fixed. So that's the advantage you have. Mostly, in general, the warm season plants, they're more C4 plants, whereas in the cooler season, they're more C3 plants. Corn, for example, is a C4 plant, very efficient. Bermuda grass, which is another one, is very efficient. Cactuses, they're C4 plants. On the other hand, some of your most important food crops, such as rice, wheat, barley, oats, most of the winter cereals, are C3 plants. So being able to convert C3 plants into the C4 mechanism would certainly improve the productivity. Yeah.
It might help if you just talk about the differences over the last 50 years in the growth and yields of wheat varieties versus growth and yields of corn varieties because of that C4 principle, just to give a feeling of magnitude of importance.
Corn has really made some tremendous growth over the past few years. In fact, the curves still look very favorable, and if we get the drought tolerance that we're hoping that some companies are able to get, that's going to add another boost. In contrast to crops such as wheat and barley and rice and some of those, we've had some gains, but not nearly as dramatic as we've had with corn. That answer your question?
Yeah, you can get on the internet and download some data series on corn and wheat and rice yields, and pretty easy to find with Google, and verify that for yourself. Take a look at it. It is a pretty striking difference. More questions. You. Okay, Anita.
Apple mixes is. In fact, when we were working on this paper, I started scratching my head about if we had to design another green revolution, what would be the areas of research I would want to identify as really putting a team of scientists on? And I initially didn't have this one, but in talking with one of my colleagues at University of Georgia who is working on apomixis, he said, "You're remiss. This is very important." Apomixis is a process of producing seed in plants without sex. And you don't have fertilization. And of course, that's the way that most plants, you have a male and a female, but it's a way of cloning a plant without having fertilization. So that means that you could have a hybrid, and if you had the process of apomixis incorporated into that plant, you could produce seed without going through the establishment of inbred lines, which is a very expensive and long-term process to produce a hybrid. So it might put the hybrid seed folks out of business, but it would be a tremendous boost that if you could produce seed from plants without fertilization, it would be a great advantage. So.
Okay, yes.
My name is Amy Cross. I'm an ag journalist, and you guys have kind of outlined really broad goals, whether it be talking and kind of bridging the gap between either the public and the private sector, or connecting with the Congress people or other countries. How do you prioritize all these different markets that you need to reach, and whose job is it to reach them?
Okay.
I think that's, if you like, sums up why we're here today. I mean, I don't think there's a single answer in my mind, and we've all of us, I think, on this panel said one way or another today that the complexity of what is ahead of us is almost mind-straining. To prioritizations, I think we've heard some suggestions of some early wins, and I think there are some out there that we should focus on. But ultimately, it still comes back to trying to find something that's going to single out a point of focus. We mentioned the very first question, I think, not trying to defocus from being paralyzed by that complexity. Whether Gail's got some comments on the particular targets, but to me, looking at the productivity piece, focusing on that is one of the places that I would start and focus our efforts.
Other responses from the panel? Okay. Any more questions? Any last question? Because you stole mine. All right. Well, I told you I don't do monologues. So with that, if there are no more questions, let's give the entire panel and the audience a round of applause. Yes.
This is not my word. It comes from T. Jefferson. That's Thomas Jefferson. And I want to quote, "He who can double his food deserves to rank among his benefactors next to his creator." Thomas Jefferson.
Okay. Gail, you got the last word almost. I'm just going to say we'll have another forum here next month, and we'll look forward to seeing you back. Thanks.